So we're going to continue on in our journey through chapter 18. In fact, we're going to finish 18 tonight. Again, another very large section as we go through this more narrative style of writing. It's not packed full of teaching and theological content. It's a story. It's a scene in this dramatic play that is unfolding before us as Jesus is heading to the cross. He's almost there. We're now in the middle of the night. At some point in the night, after Jesus has been arrested and brought into Jerusalem to the high priest's house, into the courtyard, he initially stops and talks with Annas. And as we read in chapter 18, verse 24, after Annas was done with him, he sent him bound to Caiaphas. So he sends him off to Caiaphas. And while supposedly he's with Caiaphas, or while he's on his way to Caiaphas, we have the second and third denial of Peter, that he knew Jesus and was a follower of Jesus, and the rooster crows, and he realizes he has fulfilled the prophecy that Jesus gave, that he would deny him three times before the rooster crowed. And we dealt with that last week. But you notice verse 28 then says, then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium. So what's missing? Caiaphas. All three of the synoptic gospels describe the official trial. This examination by Annas was, like I said last week, kind of a pre-trial conversation. Again, I think Annas, as the high and mighty former high priest and father-in-law of the current high priest, thinks he's probably going to be able to trip Jesus up real quick and be done with him. And if you were here last week, you remember that Jesus calls him out, says, this is ridiculous. You know this is wrong. Why are you examining me? Bring some witnesses. This isn't even a real trial. You're not even really the high priest. Just shuts him down completely. So Annas says, oh, wow, I didn't expect that. Says, sends him on to Caiaphas. But John doesn't record the examination, the actual Sanhedrin trial, where the council is gathered together. The high priests are there and all the prominent men, and they've gathered together to examine Jesus, to find him guilty. Remember, the sentence of guilt has already been given. In their hearts, they're just looking for the actual reason to kill him. They've already decided to kill him. They're trying to find the actual charge that they're going to bring against him in order to kill him. So the trial is missing. And if you've been with us, you know that John was most likely familiar with the other three Gospels as he's writing his. So that could be the only explanation for why he left it out, is he knew it was already in existence. He knew the story of the trial was already in the other three Gospels. That could be the easiest explanation for why he left it out. Everything else is, you know, just guesswork. He didn't feel like it was really necessary. He wants to focus more on the appearance of Jesus before Pilate. And he is the only one that gives us as much detail about that interaction between Jesus and Pilate. The others don't have quite as much. But John goes into great length in this interaction with Pilate. So he's more focused on the examination of the governor, the Roman governor over Judea, than he is with the Jewish leaders' council. Okay? So let's read, and we're not going to get through all of it because it goes on into chapter 19, but let's read to the end of chapter 18, starting in verse 28. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early, and they themselves did not enter into the praetorium, so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Therefore Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." So Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." To fulfill the word Jesus, which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. Therefore Pilate again entered into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Therefore Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" When he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I release someone for you at the Passover. Do you wish then that I release for you the king of the Jews?" So they cried out again, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. I love little statements like that. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Now Barabbas was a robber. He was also a murderer. Okay, so here is the initial encounter with Pilate. It goes on, actually. And there's another conversation that he has with Pilate, but we're going to stop there for tonight. There's plenty to talk about. But I did want to make sure that you're at least familiar with the Sanhedrin trial. Okay? So here's the scene. They all arrive at the high priest's house, which is just to the west and to the south of the temple. So they came off the Mount of Olives, which is to the east of the temple. They go into Jerusalem, north of the temple, and come through the city and go to the high priest's house. The high priest's house, this is like more of a, think, mansion. Okay? Very large place with a large outdoor courtyard and a gate and a fence around it. So they go through the gate and they're in the outdoor courtyard when Annas stops the procession and examines Jesus. Okay? That's when Peter kind of sneaks in and there's a little fire, charcoal fire lit in the courtyard, and the temple police and the servants of the household are all standing around the fire warming themselves. Inside of the house is the actual current high priest, Caiaphas, and the Sanhedrin, this council of rulers, ready for the trial. But Annas stops everybody outside and has this little interaction with Jesus first. And when he gets nowhere, he sends him on inside. So from the other three Gospels, here's what we know. We know that they had Jesus stand in front of them as they brought in witnesses. Okay, this was an official trial. This is how you conducted it. And how many witnesses did you need to convict somebody of a crime? Two. And all of the three Gospels, in different kinds of ways, indicate that they brought witness after witness after witness, many of whom were making things up. They were false witnesses. You see, Jesus had performed a lot of miracles. He had healed people. He had raised a guy from the dead. He had brought sight to the blind. He had taught every day in the synagogues the things of God. He hadn't really done anything wrong. So they're bringing these witnesses, and who knows where they found them, but they're bringing these false testimonies, and there was a problem. You know what the problem was? Anybody familiar with the story? None of them matched. They couldn't find two that agreed with one another. They couldn't find two liars who could come up with the same story. And so who knows how long this was carrying on. I'm sure they're getting frustrated. Annas, maybe he's joined the party by now, and they're just talking with each other. They're trying to figure out what to do. And then finally, two different people come forward, and they talk about how Jesus said that if you destroy the temple, he'll be able to rebuild it in 3 days. One of the gospel writers says that these witnesses said that if you destroy it with human hands, that he was going to rebuild it without human hands. And finally, there were two people that had a story that somewhat matched. But Mark's gospel says they didn't even quite match up all the way. They were close, but apparently it wasn't close enough. And people just, Caiaphas gets so frustrated, he throws up his hands at some point, and he stands there and he looks at Jesus and he says, "Why aren't you answering all these accusations? Why aren't you speaking up for yourself?" Why do you think he said that? Because they're getting nowhere. And Jesus is standing there, you know, humbly, patiently, defiantly, who knows, just standing there listening. Is he shaking his head? Is he grieved? Probably, the whole process. But he knows where he's going and what he's about to do. And he's not bothered. He's not upset. And it's driving Caiaphas crazy. He's not defending himself. He's not speaking. Just like Annas was trying to get Jesus to talk about his teachings, he's not saying anything so that we can trip him up. He's not defending himself from all these false accusations so that we can try to confuse him and get him to say something that's blasphemy. So he's getting furious and he's beside himself. And finally, he looks at Jesus and he says, I adjure you or I command you, by the living God, tell us if you're the Messiah. Jesus says, "Yeah, I am." It's about time you got to a good question. So here's a couple of things to understand about that. Number one, did Jesus come to contradict the law and the prophets? No, he didn't. He came to fulfill it. In every part of his life, did he thumb his nose at the law or did he follow the law? Faithfully follow the law. So here he is now at a real trial with the real high priest where they've actually brought witnesses, although they were all liars. And he has the actual high priest command him. So this man actually has spiritual authority over him by the living God to answer a question. And being a faithful Jewish man, he answers the question. Yes, I am. Second thing is, he's trying to get killed. He's there to be condemned. And they're not, they're messing it up. They're not doing it right. Finally, he can say something that solves it. Yes, I am. And from now on, he says, you're going to see me sitting at the right hand of the mighty one in heaven and coming on the clouds of heaven. Make no mistake about it. I am God. I am the Messiah. At which point Caiaphas tears his robe and says, what more do we need of witnesses? We've heard for him, for ourselves, this man is a blasphemer and deserving of death. And the council agrees. And so they meet together. They pass judgment and they send him to Pilate because they can't execute him. The Romans have taken away their authority to exercise capital punishment. So they need Pilate to execute Jesus. Okay? So that's what's just happened. So now it's really early in the morning. And history teaches us that Roman officials often got up really early. That's actually a legitimate deal. They usually got up before the sun even came up and started working. taking care of their duties. So this has happened through the night. The Sanhedrin has convened. They've passed judgment. Now it's really early in the morning. It says it was early. The sun's just starting to come up. And now they have to take Jesus back towards the temple to the north side. Most people think it was in the fortress of Antonia. You remember that from a couple of weeks ago? On the north side of the temple, which is where Pilate had set up shop. Because that's not where he lived. Pilate didn't live in Jerusalem. He lived in Caesarea, along with all those Romans that were there, those Roman soldiers that were there for the Passover. It was tradition that the governor and all of these Roman soldiers would come into town for Passover to keep the peace. It's not where they lived. So they brought him to the fortress of Antonia. They called it the Praetorium. Do you guys know why? Anybody have an idea what that means?
Well, the praetors were like the highest Roman guards, weren't they?
Yeah.
They're the ones that Paul was chained to.
Yeah. And what was their specific function? Do you remember? Do you know?
Guards and officers.
They were like the secret service. They were the secret service of the Roman Empire. They guarded the emperors and the highest officials. So because it was a place where Pilate was staying, which meant his personal bodyguard was there, it was referred to as the Praetorium. Okay? So they brought him to this place, to where Pilate was to be sentenced and executed by the Romans. So that's the scene. Okay, so let's go through it. So it was early, verse 28, and they themselves did not enter the praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Let's just deal with that for a second. What questions do you have, or what do you notice about that particular scene? And for those of you who were in the office earlier, no, don't you say anything. Okay, what's your question?
It's not a question, but they, like, Jesus was quote-unquote defiled by going into the praetorium while they didn't want to be.
Okay, interesting. He wasn't actually in it yet.
Nope.
They stayed outside, including Jesus. And so 29 says Pilate went out to them. But later in the scene, he summons Jesus into the praetorium. So yes, you're right. He does eventually go in. What do you know?
What? What was defiling about the praetorium?
Okay, good. That's a good question. What was defiling about the praetorium?
Was it far enough away, like farther than the Mount of Olives, or was it still close? Like, I remember the distance.
Right, good thought. No, it's within the distance. They're still in Jerusalem. In fact, the Antonia Fortress is connected almost to the temple. I mean, it's right there in the middle of Jerusalem. So good thought, but not right. What was defiling about this?
Entering the house of a Gentile was defiling ceremonially, whatever that word is.
Mm-hmm.
And they're about to celebrate Passover.
Okay.
They didn't want to be defiled right before then, because then they miss out on Passover.
Okay, good. And that's what it says, because so they might eat Passover. Okay, so you have a couple of things here to think about. Number one, why did that make them ceremonially unclean? That is a hard word to say. And two, what was Jesus doing with his disciples when he was washing their feet? Why were they gathered together? Eat the Passover. Right? That's what just happened. That happened, okay, if we're in the early morning hours, let's say, of Friday, that's what just happened Thursday night. And just as a side note, which is kind of fun, we were dealing with that last year. Okay? That's way back in chapter 13, when Jesus gathered together to celebrate the Passover with his disciples. That was just last night in the story. That's how much time John has devoted to this last final day and a half to 2 days of Jesus' life. Okay? So he's already eaten the Passover. Or the Passover has already happened. Or has it? What's going on, do you think, here? What? Yeah, it is. What's the duration? Anybody know? What? 7 days. Okay. So, when it says so that they might eat the Passover, a lot of people use that to say, wait a minute, there's an inconsistency here. Because, number one, that would mean the Passover is that night, the traditional Pascal, Passover lamb, the Seder meal, okay, was happening that night, the day that Jesus was being crucified, but in the other Gospels, he's crucified the day after. So there's a discrepancy here. Because it does say that so that they might eat the Passover. But as has been mentioned, that term Passover came to be known for the entire week. Okay, so keep that in mind. That's number one. Number two, we haven't answered the question, exactly what makes somebody ceremonially unclean for the Passover? It's in the law of Leviticus. Anybody know? Just going into a Gentile's house? Is that in the law? The only thing that really caused you to be ceremonially unclean, I can't believe how many times I'm having to say that word, and miss Passover was contact with a dead body. According to the law, according to the law given by God through Moses. Okay? That's in Israelite law. And if you did become ceremonially unclean by contact with a dead body, you had to miss Passover, but there was a provision for you. You could re-celebrate it the next month on the 14th day, maybe with your close family and friends so that you wouldn't be by yourself, and be able to observe the Passover. Okay? There were other minor things that could make you ceremonially unclean according to the rabbis. Do you remember we talked about how you had the law given by God through Moses? And then over the centuries, over the generations, the chief priests, and as the Pharisees developed, primarily the Pharisees and the rabbis, they began to interpret the law of God for the people. Okay? Explain it to them by writing out detailed instructions of how you follow God's law that became, to the Israelites, law itself. And so you had roughly 670 actual laws in the first five books of the Bible called the Torah. What developed that was called the traditions of the priests, or the Talmud, 5,000 more laws. Okay? This is what Jesus meant when he talked about your traditions, when he's accusing the Pharisees of making it hard on the people to follow God. He says, you make them follow your traditions and actually violate God's law. You've heaped on men burdens they cannot bear, that you yourselves can't even bear. And you're keeping them from worshiping God with your traditions. This idea of coming into a Gentile house and becoming ceremonially unclean for Passover was a rabbinic tradition. It was not in the Torah, the law of God. It was their explanation. Because who knows? There might have been a dead body in a Gentile's house. We know how evil they are. We know what terrible people they are. There might have been a dead body in that house. You don't know. What?
Could have been hope and they just struck Jesus down with it.
Yeah. Say that again.
Could have been hope and they just struck Jesus down with it.
They're going to kill him right then.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I'm missing the point. I'll come back to you later. So that was a tradition of the rabbis. And so there were several categories, according to the rabbis, according to the traditions of the priests, several different categories that could make you unclean. And a lot of them could be dealt with at sundown. Okay? And going into a Gentile house was one of the things that made you ceremonially unclean until sundown. And at sundown, you could wash and be pure again and be able to eat the Passover. Everyone following? This is important. So, this is early in the morning. If they're worried about not being able to eat the actual Passover meal, which is supposed to happen on the 14th day of the first month, which begins this week-long celebration, this doesn't come into play. Because that meal happens when? On sundown. So the sun goes down, they can wash, and they're ready to go to eat the Passover meal. Okay? If that's what they were worried about, the Passover, the actual Passover lamb, which is in remembrance of when God passed over the Israelites and didn't kill all their firstborn in Egypt, if they sacrificed this lamb and put the blood of the lamb on the door. That's what this is remembering. When he rescued Israel out of Egypt by killing all the firstborn of animals and livestock unless the blood of the lamb was over the door. That happened at sundown on the 14th day of the first month. If that's what they were worried about, they would have been okay because they could have been ceremonially clean by the meal. So it's further evidence to me that what they're referring to is the entire week festivities. And here's how it went. So on the 14th night, you had the Seder meal, the actual Passover lamb. Then the next day, you had a festival celebration. On the 15th day of the month, it was a holiday. You couldn't work. And it was a giant party in Israel. Giant, millions of Jewish people in Jerusalem on vacation. And it was called the festival celebration where they would sacrifice more animals and eat unleavened bread. And it was that 15th day, this day, that they had that giant party. And then for 6 days, they would eat unleavened bread. And on the 7th day of this week, they would have another giant party to end the Passover week where you couldn't work on the 7th day. So they're worried about the fact that if they go into this Gentile house, according to their traditions, they're going to be ceremonially unclean all day long and miss out on the giant party. The big feast. They can't participate. They can't eat. They can't be with the people. And they're the leaders. They're the high priests. They're the rabbis, the Pharisees. So they don't want to miss out on the big party. They're the leaders of the big party. That's what they're concerned about. So that's further evidence to me that this is actually Friday morning after the Thursday Seder meal. Make sense? So that's why we celebrate it the way we do. And that is in accordance with all three other Gospels. That the Last Supper happened on Thursday, the trial happened Thursday night into Friday morning, and he was crucified later that day, Friday afternoon, while the city partied. And think about what they were celebrating. So anyway, that's for another day. So turn with me to Matthew chapter 23. I promise I'll keep track of time tonight. This is the eight woes. That's what my Bible calls them. As Jesus looks at these Pharisees, these so-called leaders of Israel, who have supposedly protected the law of God and held Israel to follow God, but who have built up these 5,000 plus traditions on top of the law that have made it completely impossible for people to really worship and follow God. Jesus lets them have it. Matthew does the best job in showing the judgment and the anger, the righteous anger that Jesus had for these leaders. Look at what verse do I want to look at? 27 and 28. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. So you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had been living in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. And so you testify against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers, you serpents, you brood of vipers. How will you escape the sentence of hell? This is exactly what is happening right here in verses 28 and 29 of chapter 18. Go back to John 18. You've got these men desiring to appear righteous, and on the outside, they are whitewashed and clean. But on the inside, their hearts are filled with hatred. And they are illegally, immorally, and viciously trying to condemn a man to death because they don't believe he is the Messiah. This is the description of what is going on. Outwardly they appear righteous, but inwardly they are vile and depraved. So, Pilate, he bows to their wishes and goes out to meet them. And he says, what accusation do you bring against this man? And they answered and said to him, if this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you. So Pilate said to them, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. But the Jews answered, we are not permitted to put anyone to death. So think about this. Think about this scene. Think about what's happened over the last 12 hours. What's going on? What do you see? What are some of the ideas and motives behind what's going on? Sure. So I see Jews trying to get their way without having blood on their hands, maybe. That's an interesting point. What else do you see?
I think it feels a little bit snarky when they're like, it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death.
Okay.
It's also kind of like, I feel like they're trying to cover their butts for more of that unceremonial uncleanliness.
Sure.
Because they're like, if we don't kill him, it's on you, so we're right. Still good.
Now, this is a point to think about here. In Israelite law, when you have a blasphemer, when you have a false prophet, what is to be done? Stoning, right? If Rome was not in charge and had not taken away the Israelites' ability to execute somebody, what would have happened to Jesus? He would have been stoned. Then they would have a problem on their hands. They would have a what? A dead body during Passover. Okay? So something to keep in mind. I think there is part of that. They're trying to get this off of their hands and stay clean. There's also an interesting thing about how the rest of that sentence says to fulfill the words of Jesus, but we're going to go into that here in a minute, so don't go there yet. What else do you see about this interaction? Jacob used the word snarky. I see a lot of snarkiness, if that's a real word. It sounds cool. I like the word.
And they still don't even give the reason or a reason for why. They're just like, oh, we bring him because he's bad. Like, why would we be here? He's bad.
Okay, this is a good point. Now, skip ahead to fully understand this point for just a second, and then we'll come back. What does Pilate ask Jesus once he gets him alone? Are you the king of the Jews? So obviously Pilate's got some information here. Okay? So Pilate's got some information. Why does he ask the question he asks? Because I think that might indicate why the Jews respond the way they do.
Which question are we asking?
What accusation do you bring against this man? Right. That's the angle the Jews are taking, aren't they? That's what they're trying to communicate. Think about who went to arrest Jesus. A cohort of Roman soldiers. Where was that cohort living? In the fortress of Antonia. Who would have been involved in sending the cohort in the first place? Pilate. If you weren't here, a cohort is 600 Roman soldiers. It is possible that that word could also mean a handful. It's used that way sometimes. That is actually a technical term. Handful means a third of a cohort. So 200 soldiers. So there's at least 200 Roman soldiers involved in the arresting of Jesus. Now they've come back. Okay? Do you think maybe Pilate may have been involved in some way? Do you think maybe there's already been some communication? We know from history, writings of historians of this time period, that this man Pilate, he was a bit of an insecure megalomaniac. He was a weak man who was constantly, desperately clinging to power. Okay? And so most people see his question as a shocking question. It caught the Jews off guard. What are the Jewish leaders expecting at this point, do you think? What?
A handoff.
Rubber stamp. We've got this all worked out. The plan is finally falling into place. We've been able to condemn him to death for being a blasphemer according to our law. So now we just need to hand him over to Pilate. Pilate's already in on the situation. Let Pilate kill him. We're good. Let's go have a party. So they show up and Pilate decides to play with them. Pilate decides to mess with them. I think that's exactly what happened. What charge do you bring against this man? Like, what? We wouldn't have brought him here if he wasn't an evildoer. You know, what do you mean, what charge? Here, take him and kill him. Right? Freaked him out. He said, we wouldn't have brought him here. We've already tried him. We've convicted him. He's now a condemned man to death. It's already done. Why, Pilate, are you starting a new trial? That's what happened. Pilate started a new trial. A Roman trial. And now the Israelites are scared. They're like, our plan, oh crap. Why is he... He just started a new trial. He's asking us to bring charges. We haven't thought about the charges. You know? We've already charged and convicted him. So he says, well, if you say so, go try him yourself. Go judge him according to your laws. I think this humiliates them. I think he's toying with them so bad. I think he's messing with their heads. You try him. He knows darn well what's already happened. He knows exactly what Jews, the Jewish leaders want him to do. And he's decided he's not going to play along. You go charge him. I think that's what's happening. That's my opinion. You guys read it, you pray through it, and you think about it yourself. But just from the beginning, the complicity of these two groups of people, the hated enemies, the Jews and the Romans, the occupiers, the evil dogs that were oppressing the Jews, the Romans who thought of the Jewish people as subhuman, below them, their servants, they had conquered them. They were tired of them, always griping about their temple and their Jewish laws. These were hated enemies now working together to arrest and execute this man, Jesus. There's already so much complicity here, but now Pilate's starting to make things interesting, starting to mess with him a little bit.
Is this before or after Pilate's wife?
Okay, so that's not in John's gospel. But in, I think, I printed them all out. I think it's in Mark's, but it could be Matthew, where it's during this time. He's already examining Jesus. They're already having this interaction, and his wife sends word to him, have nothing to do with this man. I've suffered all night long in terrible dreams because of him. So she's really freaked out, and she sends word to Pilate, her husband, that this something's going on here that you don't want to be a part of. So that happens while at some point in this examination, but it's not actually in John's account. Okay. So he says, you go judge him according to your law. So the Jews are forced to show their dependence. They're forced to show their humility. They're forced to show their place in this current situation. And say, we can't. We can't. We can't carry out the sentence. We've already judged him, but that's as far as we can go. He's deserving of death, and we cannot put anyone to death. Interesting. And so John adds in verse 32, this was to fulfill the word of Jesus, which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. There are a couple of things I want you to notice about this. Turn with me to Mark chapter 10. Jesus, in telling his disciples what's coming, he has said it to him several times. He's explained it to him. But listen to the description. Oh, I left something out. After they judged Jesus in the Sanhedrin, they started to beat on him. If you remember that part of the story. Once the sentence was pronounced, he's a blasphemer. He deserves to die. They started slapping him, spitting on him. I guess they would... try to slap him without him seeing and say, prophesy who slapped you. Maybe they blindfolded him. I don't know. But that's in the other gospel accounts that they started slapping him before they sent him over to Pilate. So here's what Jesus has told his disciples months, maybe even more than a year ago. Mark chapter 10, verses 33 and 34. Jesus is saying to them, behold, we are going up to Jerusalem. So this is probably sooner than that, right before it's happened. And the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, which is the Sanhedrin. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him. And 3 days later, he will rise again. So he has exactly predicted what is happening to him right now. But I don't think that's exactly what John intends to communicate when he says that this was to fulfill the words of Jesus. You know what I think John is communicating? Because it's in John's gospel three times. Three times Jesus tells the followers of his that just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the desert, so the Son of Man is going to be lifted up. And that's a crazy story that we don't have time for. But in the same way, that was a foreshadowing of the fact that Jesus would not be stoned as a blasphemer according to Jewish law, but would be lifted up on a cross and murdered according to Roman tradition to take away the sins of the world. I think that's what John is connecting to there. Three times. I'll let you write it down because I'm running short on time. It's in chapter 3, verse 14, chapter 8, verse 28, and chapter 12, verse 32. Three times Jesus refers to the fact that he is going to be lifted up and die for the sins of the world. Okay. We are at a crossroads. There's no way I can finish this in 4 minutes. I really thought I could get through this. I'm sorry. This is actually a really good place to stop. Because now we transition into a one-on-one encounter, or at least a private encounter, as Pilate goes back into the fortress at Antonia and has Jesus brought to him. They have this little private interaction. I'm going to save that for next week. How about that? Does that sound okay to you guys? I think we've dealt with enough tonight. So let me try to, because I didn't intend to do it now, but let me try to kind of tie this all together. You know what I see in this first, how many verses is it? 3, 4, 5 verses. I see the representation of the human condition. I see the hypocrisy of the Jewish leaders trying to win their righteousness by observance of the law when inside they are dead and they are so far apart from God and they don't even know it because they feel that they can earn their way into His good graces, that they are good enough to be right with God according to their birth and according to how well they follow the law. And the hypocrisy with which they carry out God's law. That's why Jesus looked at him and said, "Learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice." Even though the law, the old covenant, was so prescriptive in its traditions and its sacrifices and its rules, it's always been about the heart of the people towards God. It's always been about a belief, a faith in a God who loves them and wants to rescue them. And as long as you kept that heart, you were considered righteous. Because God had in mind from the beginning that He was going to pour out His wrath against sin on a perfect sacrifice. And so as long as you had that heart with Him, He counted that as righteous, as faith in the eventual righteous sacrifice. It's always been about that. The Pharisees, they may have started with good intentions to protect God's law, but they really got off track. And it became about their place in society, in the being the keepers of the law. Boy, did they lose it in developing over 5,000 additional laws to try to explain God's law. So I see that in their hypocrisy. I see the complicity I've already mentioned, this collusion of enemies to carry out an immoral, unjust execution of a man. Just the evil intent of that is disturbing. I see the insecurity of Pilate, you know? I mean, he can't even follow along in this plan that they've cooked up. He's so desperate for power and authority and recognition in his place, driven by that, that he's messing with people just to try to keep them down, the oppression of that. I don't think he's doing it to entertain himself. I think he's doing it to put the Jews in their place. I think he's annoyed the fact that the Jews have even tried to use him in their stupid scheme. And so he's going to teach them a lesson. See that, the insecurity and the pride of that, all just kind of coming together to carry out this plan of God from the very beginning. This evil, corrupt people doing the worst that they can imagine, and in doing that, actually fulfilling the purposes of God in bringing about the condemnation of a righteous, perfect, holy sacrifice, so that God can be both just and the justifier of those who through faith in Him have forgiveness. It's powerful. This is where we are as a race of people. We are desperately sick. I love that phrase. Where is it? Now I'm going to forget. It's Jeremiah 17. The heart is desperately sick. Who can understand it? We are driven by the pride of life towards arrogance or insecurity. It's all from the same source. Selfishness, anger, jealousy, bitterness, it all comes out of the pride that we have in thinking that we are the center of the universe, instead of understanding our place as created in His image for His glory in a relationship with Him. And we are stuck there. We are no better than the Jews. We are no better than Pilate. We are no better than any of these people in this scene. The only difference is that the Holy Spirit has opened our eyes to see who Jesus really is. To see this man who stands there meekly, not opening his mouth, like it was prophesied in Isaiah, the passage that they read tonight, but willingly allowing himself to be led to the slaughter. We have seen the truth. God has opened our eyes and our hearts, and we recognize it and we've embraced it according to His glorious grace and mercy in our life. That's the only difference. And if you ever start thinking, like they did, back what I read to you, oh, if we had been in this scene, if we were there, we wouldn't have done this to Jesus. Oh, yes, you would have. Apart from the grace of God, oh, yes, you would have. We are just like them with a significant little difference. It's that we believe that He is the Messiah. And because of that, we have been counted righteous before God. Powerful. All praise to Him. So we'll finish this interaction. So now I don't know what to do. Do I start here and go through all the way through 19? I don't think so. We'll see. I'll pray about it and look at it, and we'll see how we go next week. But I hope you come back and finish this story, because this interaction between Jesus and Pilate is staggering, and it's profound, and it's exciting, and I can't wait to share it with you. Let me pray. God, thank You for tonight, for this opportunity that we've had to worship You by sitting and praising Your name and sitting and surrendering ourselves to Your Word, submitting ourselves to the authority of Your Word. Learning about You, learning about ourselves, I pray that this would all cause us to be just more intimately aware of Your presence, more willing to submit ourselves to You, abide in You, allow You to be our treasure, the goal of our life, and that you would be praised as a result of it. I pray this in your name, Jesus. Amen.